When you're ready, Mr. Ennis.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Chad Ennis. I represent Spread Spectrum Screening. I'll probably refer to it, it's kind of a tongue twister, so I'm going to probably refer to it as S3 as we go along.
Okay, thank you.
Just to save the tongues. But the key to this appeal, and what's really ignored by the defendants in their briefs and at the court below, is the difference between the accused products as to the different sets of defendants in this case. It's what the distinction the district court missed, and that's the distinction that we've made all along.
Why does that distinction make the case appealable?
It makes it appealable because basically the district court has ended our case. We're effectively out of court using the Moses Cone terminology as to a class of infringers, really, and especially these particular infringers.
Don't those cases discuss circumstances in which you've essentially surrendered the opportunity to have your case considered in a federal jurisdiction to either a state or an administrative body?
I don't. That's a narrow view of Moses Cone. I think Moses Cone is broader than that. And basically, Moses Cone derives itself from Landis. And Landis says an indefinite stay, absent a pressing need, is an abuse of discretion. And then the other courts have used that to say that an indefinite stay is also effectively out of court. It's very intertwined.
Here you're still in court. You're in a federal court in New York, and then you can go back to this federal court once that is resolved.
But we're not in court as to this claim, 18, and to the infringing products that infringe that claim, the binary reproductions, were out. And you look at the cases that discuss what an indefinite stay is. It's a confusing term, I think, because what indefinite really applies to is the length of time of the stay. So all these cases that surrender the case to another body, you say, well, how long is the stay going to last? And in this case, we don't know. It could be 6 months. It could be 7 to 8 years.
Putting aside the issue of whether the stay should have been entered, I still don't understand how that creates an appealable issue.
Right. Well, so let's... Basically, I think what you're asking is an indefinite stay render you effectively out of court? And that's the rule, we think. And if you look at
how
Ninth
do you
Circuit,
deal with Kahn and Katz, and how does the those two cases affect this one?
Well, I think Kahn is right on for this point, because Kahn says that a misapplication of the customer suit doctrine is appealable.
Well, Kahn said appealable if you have irreparable harm that you can show.
I don't think that's part of the holding of Kahn. I think that's part of that was a concern in Kahn, but is also if there is irreparable harm, it will certainly be appealable. But
didn't Kahn have an injunction in it?
Kahn did have an injunction in it.
So that enabled it to be appealable in any event.
But if you look further, the cases that interpreted Kahn, such as Tejik, there's no injunction issue in Tejik, and it is applied Kahn.
This isn't even a first-to-file circumstance, though, is it?
Well, out that way, but it's ended up that way, because
But the first-to-file doctrine is very specific. It has to do with two different races to two different courthouses, and the issue of the comity between the judicial officers overseeing those cases and the sovereigns overseeing those cases. Here, you don't have that. you do have a judge who, in one case, decided to split off an action and send it to where it should have been properly venued. But this is not a first-to-file circumstance, is it?
Well, first of all, venue was proper in Chicago. Venue, there was never a proper challenge to venue. There was a convenience that moved Kodak to New York. But once the case was severed against Kodak and placed in New York, and you have a case in Chicago, you're exactly in the customer suit doctrine situation.
But the underlying policy concerns about first to file don't exist.
But the underlying policy concerns about first to file may not exist. But what's driving the policy concerns behind why you're trying to figure out which case should obtain priority is what really the customer suit doctrine. So you have two cases. Which case should we give priority? Which case should be allowed to go ahead? And which case should be stayed in this case?
But the customer suit doctrine is a very narrow exception to the rules that say interlocutory orders are not appealable, right? And it's premised on these policy concerns about first to file, is it
not? Well, I think it's actually premised, in my view, it's premised more on that customer suit doctrine inherently involves an indefinite stay. Because you are staying one of the proceedings pending the outcome of another proceeding. And the case law on down the line is very clear that staying one case pending the outcome of another is indefinite. The stay rendered is indefinite.
Isn't this a case where the two cases were filed on the same day?
In
this case, weren't they filed?
We filed one case.
That was the one case that was
one separate. Case, and it was split. And so, yes.
So they filed on the same day.
They filed on the same day. And now the district court split them and was asked to basically determine which case should be given priority, if either.
And the remaining defendants who weren't transferred to Western District of New York were 2% of the sales? In other words, not major factors.
Well, and that gets to the point. And that gets to the point that the district court missed. Yes, it is 2% of Kodak's product Staccato. But there's also another product that the printer defendants make on their own, which is a binary reproduction that is an infringement of Claim 18 of the patent, which does not depend on any type of mask, which Staccato is a screening mask. It's, as my colleague coined the phrase, mask agnostic. It doesn't care what kind of mask you use. You don't have to use a mask at all. You could use other methods of halftoning, such as aero diffusion or other kinds. So to tie it to Kodak's sales, to tie the printers to Kodak sales is kind of a red herring, because that's not what we're...
Well, that's not the only claim you have against the customers. You also have all the same claims that you asserted against Kodak, right?
Absolutely.
You happen to have one extra claim against
them. There is certainly overlap from claims 1 to 17, and that will be primarily the printer defendant's use of Staccato. I mean, they use other masks also.
Right. I mean, even if I accept your proposition that Kahn and Katz should apply in these circumstances, despite the different procedural posture, even Katz said you don't have to have, the one case doesn't have to completely resolve the other as long as it'll materially affect it.
Well, Katz does say that, but I think the majority of cases are against Katz on that point. And if you look, for example, Tejik says the other case must resolve all claims. If you look at, there's a district court case, Teleconference, it's out of Delaware. They characterize that test as outcome determinative. And that makes sense, because if you stay a case against one set of defendants, what you're really saying is, this case over here, the case in the Western District of New York, is going to take care of this. We're going to get judicial economy and S3, you're going to be made whole.
Well, he could be saying, we'll come back and take care of you later. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, a stay, and especially this indefinite stay, I mean, this stay could last, and Kodak has actually moved to stay the New York case now. So it could be even longer. This could be a 7-year stay. Time to trial in Western District of New York is 5 years.
What's the harm?
There's evidentiary prejudice.
What's the harm?
The evidence of the main harm is the evidentiary proof you need for the printer defendants is printouts, actual prints, to analyze and see where the dots are under Claim 18. Well, these aren't something that they maintain or keep in the ordinary business. They could shift products in the meantime. You know, a whole host of different things could come about where their evidence will not be still available that they infringe Claim 18. So, I mean, that is the evidentiary prejudice, and that's the prejudice that will suffer from the stay. The district court didn't take that into account at all because the district court didn't even address the distinction between Claims 1 to 17 and Claim 18.
Of course, this is an abuse of discretion standard.
It is an abuse of discretion standard, and I think it is in this case, it is an abuse of discretion because I think going back again, and it's
you worry that you'll lose evidence, but the parties have an ongoing obligation to preserve evidence, don't they?
They should. They've never, as far as I know, have not agreed to maintain copies of every print.
It's not a question of whether they agree; it's a question of their obligation. Don't they have an obligation to preserve evidence?
They do have that obligation. And
well, then what's your worry about evidentiary prejudice?
Maybe you worry that people die.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There are witnesses that could pass along. I mean, this is a very potentially lengthy stay. I mean, loss of evidence is simply one thing. The patent actually expires
Are there specific witnesses that you can identify who are potential to be lost?
Well, it would be employees of the
specific witnesses.
I cannot give you a name, no, Your Honor. I could explain to you the types of witnesses that may be lost, but.
But we're not talking about lost sales in the interim. And their monetary damages could still be available, correct?
Monetary damages will still be available. I mean, I don't think we can deny that at all.
Let's hear from Mr. Feldman, and we'll come back to you then, Mr. Hennis. Mr. Feldman?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, appearing on behalf of respondents Eastman Kodak Corporation, Genesis Press, Inc., Continental Web Press, Inc., Graphic Partners, and Johns Burns Company.
Have you moved to stay the New York action as well?
No, Your Honor. We moved to transfer. That, as your colleague correctly adverted to, this is not a race to the courthouse case. We did not file under the Declaratory Judgment Act and have to deal with that. We did move the pending action on a request for re-exam, which has been granted with all claims canceled. So that point is correct.
So you did. The
question is whether we had initially filed there. But yes, we have moved to stay.
And you're saying on re-exam, the proposal is that all the claims be canceled?
We've already have a ruling that all claims are canceled on the first office action. The court has not ruled on the request for a stay yet.
Of course, in first office action, that's pretty typical, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know about the statistics.
It's not rare, at least.
Yes, that's right. That doesn't help us much.
Yes. So we're here as a result of an improper attempt to manipulate venue law. There is no jurisdiction. Three menu items have been offered by S3 for jurisdiction. This court has held in POSTEC versus TiVo that it must address jurisdiction as a matter of first instance. And in both the POSTEC case and in the Nystrom versus Trek case, there were pending counterclaims. This court said that there was no final jurisdiction under 1295A1. There's no jurisdiction there. The first basis offered by S3. Moreover, as the POSTEC court noted, that there had been no application for certification of this interlocutory order.
Mr. Feldman, in Katz and Kahn, we have one case where it seems to require the customers to consent to be bound by the results in the other case, and another one where there's no such requirement. Is that relevant here?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
We have to resolve that, do you think, to rule in this case?
No, Your Honor. Kodak has already taken responsibility for any infringement that may have occurred out of the use of staccato in the New York action. The Kahn case, which S3 relies upon, apart from the fact that footnote 3 makes it clear that the Federal Circuit at that time was relying upon Second Circuit law, whereas now relies upon its own authority to determine jurisdiction. The Kahn case says, as to the third basis for jurisdiction that is claimed by S3, that section 1292A1, that is denial or granting of an injunction, in other words, trying to treat a stay as an injunction, it says, the case before us is not a matter of an order by a federal court that relates only to the conduct or progress of litigation before that court, ordinarily not having the effect of an injunction and therefore not appealable under section 1292A1. And that's Kahn versus General Motors, 889 F2nd, 1078, 1080. So the lead authority for S3 dispatches the third and final basis for jurisdiction claimed for this appeal.
Our Gould case says that a stay becomes actionable if it's going to be for a protracted and indefinite period of time. Why isn't the likely 5-year delay in this case a protracted period?
Well, Your Honor, as to how much time remaining for the Western District of New York, that may be speculation, but the key point...
The Fifth Circuit has said 3 years is protracted. The Ninth Circuit has said 6 years is protracted.
Yes,
Your Honor. We're looking at something in the neighborhood of the Ninth Circuit and something far beyond what the Fifth Circuit found protracted.
Well, this court in Gould versus Laser Control said that under 28 U.S.C. section 1295, quote, stay orders should not ordinarily be viewed as final and thus within the jurisdiction of an appellate court. And
you're not answering my question. It's going to take 5 years to get to trial in the Western District of New York. That's kind of a standard estimate. Why isn't that a protracted period?
Well, Your Honor, it's not protracted because the key issue is whether the case will receive district court review and then this court's review. If this court were to find jurisdiction...
That's not addressing the question of whether it's a protracted period. Fifth Circuit, we just went through this. 3 years is protracted. We're looking at least 5 years here. Why isn't that protracted?
Your Honor, the court had to balance that possibility of a 5-year delay along with judicial economy. You would have multiple Markman hearings. You'd have customer defendants who have no basis to defend all but one of the claims because they have no access to the software. In managing its own docket and having its inherent authority, the trial court had to take into account and made findings of fact. They know nothing about the software. They don't have access to the software.
How does the Patent Office proceeding weigh in the balance here? That's not likely to be 5 years, is it?
No, Your Honor.
And if they lose the patent there, then it's over?
That would be correct, Your Honor. And moreover, in terms of the appellant's position that the trial court did not have an appreciation for the theory, appellants changed their theory of liability in the complaint. From paragraph 48 and 51 says you have joint infringement here, that the customers are liable as for direct infringement for using the Staccato software to print newspapers, to print out, to make
prints.
You
indemnified the customers?
Your Honor, that's not before this court. It's not in the record. We don't have any outstanding disputes with the customers, and Kodak is defending them all in the Western District of New York.
What response did you all give to the cross-claim?
That's been settled, Your Honor. In regards to the latest theory by appellant,
if you're not indemnifying the customers, how is that taking responsibility?
Well, indemnification would be a private matter between the parties here, but Kodak represented the court that it has taken responsibility for any infringement arising out of the use of the Staccato software by its customer defendants.
I don't understand what that means. Taking responsibility mean?
Well, it would mean it would pay damages. It pays defense
Why
costs.
Why isn't that indemnification?
Well, it may very well be. I just, it's not an issue that was put in the record by appellants, and it does certainly jurisdiction and abuse of the stay. Abuse of discretion does not turn on that. But if I could just point the court, that appellant has shifted their theory here from its opening brief to its reply brief. So in the opening brief, the S3 says on pages 3, 4, and 13 that the customer defendants are infringing by use of the Staccato software. They're creating these separate printouts.
If S3 prevails on validity and infringement in New York, are you saying that you'll concede then when we go back, when you go back to the printer defendants?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not. It's not clear what shadow of a case
taking responsibility doesn't mean that, huh?
Well, that was not raised before the Northern District of Illinois. It's likely S3. No, Your Honor, that's not been before asked by the court or addressed or briefed.
That was claim 18.
That would be, Your Honor, Kodak has said it would be responsible, and that includes Claim 18, which is pleaded against Kodak and the customer defendants, contrary to S3's position in the complaint.
Where's the judicial economy here that you were arguing to us so passionately a moment ago, if you're going to relitigate validity and infringement the second time when it goes back? You're not going to take responsibility, as you said a minute ago. You're going to relitigate.
Well,
where is the judicial economy?
The judicial economy is that even S3 concedes that claims 1 through 17 will be dispatched in the Western District of New York.
And if you lose, you will agree to that, right? If you lose on validity and infringement 1 through 17, you will concede that when you go back.
Yes, Your Honor. We're not in a position to relitigate that.
I understand.
And we have a validity defenses that you can't get a patent on printed matter under Section 101.
So you won't relitigate any of those when you go back with the printer defendants?
Correct, Your Honor. And then Claim 18 may well be resolved on a validity defense or even on direct infringement in the Western District of New York, because they've all been pleaded against all of the respondents here. Every claim, not just 1 through 17. They pleaded the Kodak had induced by sale of the Staccato software to the customer defendants, and by their use of that in printout, that they were infringing Claim 18.
Is it correct that severance is not at issue on this appeal, just the stay?
Correct, Your Honor.
And is it also correct you're making every effort to preserve all the evidence that would be needed for both trials?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. You look on the in the reply, they claim now in their brief that this Claim 18 is not tied to the use of any particular software or system such as Kodak's accused Staccato product. In their opening brief, page 4, they say, instead the printer defendants use Kodak products during the manufacture of their own unique and separately infringing products, which infringe other claims, e.g. Claim 18 of the patent suit. So just as the theory of liability shifted before the trial court, to have a contradictory theory of liability, that liability was separate and distinct for the customer defendants, contrary to paragraphs 48 and 52 of the complaint. Here on appeal, the opening position is, well, yes, they have separate liability through the use of Staccato. There's no other product identified in the complaint. And now on the reply brief, they're saying, well, there's some other phantom software that might be out there for which there could be residual liability.
If severance isn't on appeal here, and we're only dealing with the stay, we deny the stay, or reverse, we find jurisdiction, then there won't be any judicial economy because there'll be two trials. The only way to attain judicial economy is to preserve the stay. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
Either by finding no jurisdiction or on the merits.
Exactly correct, Your Honor. There won't be two Markman hearings. There won't be litigation of claims 1 through 18 in both jurisdictions. There won't be the risk of inconsistent results. Their case is being advanced in the Western District of New York, and if anything is left of it, it will be disposed of in the Northern District of Illinois. The district court has used its inherent authority to stay its own proceedings. There's no abuse of discretion in that, and they bear the burden of showing that there's a clearly erroneous finding of fact to support the stay. They haven't even appealed but one of the five findings of fact that the court used to ground its stay decision. So apart from jurisdiction and apart from the lack of record support to demonstrate that there's been an abuse of discretion in this case by the trial court, which should be deferred to because it's closer to the facts. The argument was considered below by the trial court, and you can see that in Joint Appendix page 412, where Kodak references the joinder by its co-respondent, Genesis Press, saying, this latest theory of independent liability under Claim 18, it's contradicted by the complaint, it's not patentable subject matter, it should be disregarded. The fact that it's not in the stay order does not mean that the court abused its discretion. And as to S3 arguing that, well, there's nothing in the record to show prejudice, you essentially have S3 for the first time on appeal arguing prejudice. The only party to raise the potential risk of prejudice was co-respondent Genesis in the appendix on page 213. There were no affidavits from S3. There was no argument made. Yet now they are finding fault with the district court's decision, which would streamline this case, get rid of S3 concedes at least all but one claim. Both parties agree that, or Kodak's position is claim 18 will be resolved as well. And this will save a lot of judicial resources for the court. Finally, Your Honor, apart from this particular case, there is also the risk that if this court finds jurisdiction, it sweeps away the POSTEC versus TiVo case, it sweeps away Nystrom versus Tech, and it finds jurisdiction, ignores Kahn with regards to treating a stay as an injunction, that it could well open a major hole in its Section 1404A jurisprudence. You'll see many more lawsuits against customers of OEMs in order to stick those customers in an unfavorable patent jurisdiction.
The slippery slope argument, is that what you're telling us?
Well, it won't be a slippery slope, Your Honor. We think there will be lots of lawsuits. There will be lots of appeals based claiming that stays are injunctions and a widening of jurisdiction.
District courts just willy-nilly issuing stays? Is that what you're telling us?
No, Your Honor. It will be customers being sued, Your Honor.
Okay.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Feldman. Mr. Annis, you have 3.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, and as we made this point in our brief, and Kodak's, again, talked about our complaint, and they ignore the claims against the printers. There's a section on...
Mr. Ennis, you just heard Mr. Feldman say that he's going to be bound by the results in New York. You heard him say he's preserving evidence. You heard his whole argument. What are your concerns somewhat allayed here?
Not really. I heard we will take responsibility for Staccato, their product, and infringements from Staccato. Again, if you read the complaint, the allegations against the printer defendants are broader than Staccato. They are not based on Staccato. The printer defendants do infringe the patent by using Staccato.
But he's right that you
they
do
infringe
assert
it other ways.
He's right that you do assert Claim 18 against Kodak as well.
For Kodak's use of Staccato.
And as
to
inducing
themselves.
Infringement.
In inducing, correct, Your Honor. But the printer defendants, I believe part of Kodak's submission to the lower court said that one of the defendants uses it 30 times in 5 years. Well, they've made a lot more prints than that over the course of 5 years. And we're entitled to seek damages on those prints as well. Not just the Kodak Staccato prints, because Kodak was a party to the case. I mean,
we won't be prohibited from doing that.
We won't, but it will be, as Judge Rader pointed out, 5 to 7 years, which courts have found to be an abuse of discretion in the Fifth Circuit and all of the Ninth Circuit. If you look, the jurisdictional question.
Did you consider a writ of mandamus?
We did, Your Honor. We felt that the finality and was a good enough basis and try not to muddy the waters with a secondary basis of a writ. I mean, this could be converted into a writ, but I think the issues boil down to a lot of the same issues. But as far as jurisdiction goes, Blue Cross, which is a Ninth Circuit case, lays out and talks in detail about Moses Cone and also then has a section on indefinite stays. So, and how the majority position is an indefinite stay is an abuse or renders jurisdiction. So I would invite the court to read that case. In the cases cited there, there are several from all over the country and all the circuits. Not all of the circuits, but the majority of the circuits. Cases like Johnson & Johnson from the 7th, Kahn, they cite. They cite several others, Hines in the 5th Circuit. And so the indefinite stay gives the jurisdiction. And strangely, the indefinite stay also is an abuse of discretion. Putting us out of court as to these printers for who knows how long is an abuse of discretion.
So. Thank you, Mr. Ennis.
Thank you.
Concludes our morning.
All rise.